What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since the camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics. Activism and action.
And there's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on! It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be my riot buddy.
I'm escaping to the one place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my God.
Welcome to the Three Left Show. I am your host, Dan Platt. I have the documents. This program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective, as well as inter-left dialogue. For the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. A left that is of itself and for itself. The meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts, and we proudly wave the flags of it. So you had a thought about the jury system.
Yes,
or
I
something
did.
To add on to it.
So before the show played, we had a small advertisement for the jury system and for the fact that it's our civic duty to be on the jury. However, what you may not know is if you are on a jury, you have a lot more power than you think you do. You have the power of nullification. Nullification means that even if the person on trial is guilty, even if they technically did what the state says they did, you don't have to punish them. You can nullify their charge. You can say, we choose not to punish this person. If what they were doing while technically illegal was justified, you can say, hey, good on ya.
Citizen deliberation can go even further in an ideal system, like, say, a reformed criminal justice system that isn't an injustice system, would be more restorative, and where the jury has a list of options for remuneration, rehabilitation, whatever kind of form it takes. The community accountability board that I was, a member of, we would have the offender write an apology letter. It could be to their parents if they're a teenager. It could be some loved one. It could be to themselves if there's no other person that needs to be apologized to. Or it could be to whoever they robbed or stole, shoplifted. Like, give it to the store. Like, oh, I'm sorry. I hurt your workers. Because you have to take the cost out of their paycheck. Of course, that maybe makes them a little more class conscious. That kind of stuff. And then also, like, steps to get their life, quote-unquote, back on track.
Right.
Like, you need to find a job, come back with 5 references, or, like, evidence that you applied to 5 different jobs.
Right.
Or if it's, like, say, maybe they're not in a working age or condition, it's, like, take up a hobby, have evidence of that hobby.
Yeah.
Or goal. Like, sometimes it would be, like, if they did the crime because they were bored, list your goals. What kind of goals could you have? And, of course, they do have some kind of dream.
Yeah.
And writing it down is kind of like the first getting it out there.
Of course.
It's like, okay, here are some things you can do to help make that dream happen. Because, without a mentor or, an internship of some kind, you don't have that direction. Especially if you're out of school or maybe they're in school but they're not getting the attention.
But, yeah, it's not necessary to have a justice system based solely on punishment.
No. I have some enlightened centrist friends and whatnot who I have to work at convincing them that punishment shouldn't be the default nor even need to be an option, because there's the attitude that if you take punishment out of the equation, you're left with nothing.
Right.
And it's like, no, there's so much more that could be done.
Like rehabilitation.
And what's usually missing is there's always the funding. Like when we say defund, abolish prisons and police,
yeah,
we mean putting that money that resources, the time of the DA's office into developing the programs to transition to the restorative. And maybe they're not convinced that the restorative works, though all the evidence is there.
Right.
I think in the discussion that I recently had with my good friend, that he didn't even seem to register. I found that odd.
Yeah.
Because he's looking at the results currently of a case here in Albany where you had a teen in a shooting where a toddler was like shot because the bullet went through like a house wall, and there was no program to put him in somehow. Wow. I don't know why there wasn't. He wasn't given any restorative thing. He wasn't put in the cab because it was, I guess, a violent crime, right? It was a felony, and we don't have that set up fully yet, a cab board for felonies, though. The DA has apparently had been on it for years, usually trying to start with assaults, which would count as assaults between gang members. If you can't get like former gang members to mediate, which you have House of Peace and Cure Violence or Snug 518 doing that work, like they should be formalized into the process, but they're not. So instead, he was just given probation, which is nothing.
Yeah.
And then next year, he was part of another gun crime, and he actually did kill someone.
Ugh.
And so he just sees that as the ultimate failure of not punishing. Yeah. That's how he was putting it to me. So I have some, this is more like recent events, but also conversation starters. So here's one. So this is a random Facebook post going through my feed about recent events. Here, this one's about the quote unquote RNC and mostly about the Republican versus Democrat, you know, false dichotomy show and how messaging going forward. And, you know, we can talk about how it affects us. It's pathetic that during the RNC, Trump and the Republicans could correctly seize onto the idea that Black Lives Matter needs to go beyond police shootings. But they're hooked onto it from a black-on-black crime angle without ever having to admit the root of the problem is capitalism. Then they'd have to act on it. You know, if you actually, when you say it's a personal problem, there's no policy to address it. You know, unless it's mentorships or something. Some kind of personal-like program that's actually really cheap. And then, of course, is just social safety net stuff at best. They can get away with that, though, because Democrats stay hooked on police violence as a white-on-black problem, but also still do nothing about it. What a game. Join or support an internationalist, working-class-oriented, African-led organization like Black Alliance for Peace so we can figure this thing out together. So Black Alliance for Peace is kind of almost a counter-organization to Black Lives Matter trademark, because BLM, as an organization, is in the Democratic Party orbit. This is because it's correct to point out there's Soros money there.
Yeah.
There's other Democratic donors who maybe want to support progressive like these politics, but only in the arena of saying we need police reform. What form does that take? Is it a community control?
Yeah.
Hell no. It's what our local government here is doing, or governments, which is like, we're going to look and study the problem. We're going to try to get more Black police officers. We're going to, oh yeah, they're doing an audit of police practices.
Oh, an audit.
I mean, because we know from the stats that they're doing everything that police in America do, which is they arrest and stop Black people more than white people.
Yep.
Because they are patrolling the hoods.
Yeah.
More than the uptown neighborhoods, which get robbed, but, you know, or there's thefts there, because it's more about like trying to contain the poor, so they're not harassing the middle class.
Right,
that's like the main unspoken policy, but it's, you can see it in how they do their patrols.
Yeah.
So, any thoughts on the difference between Republicans and Democrats in this situation? And
I mean, they're both cut from the same corporate oligarchical cloth is my two cents.
Mm-hmm. So let's see, here's a different one. This is more about the murders in Kenosha.
Oh, yep.
Let's see. Posted by Scott Leggett, but written by an Amy Raholt. Quoting, by Nass Multi, So it's, I guess, another person wrote it. It deeply pains me to say this, but I think the U.S. has crossed a point of no return after Kyle Rittenhouse's attack. Not because the attack was significant on its own. Many attacks have had more casualties. It's significant because for the first time, the conservative sphere has widely embraced a terrorist attack and hails the perpetrator as a hero. I'm Moroccan. I have closely followed the wave of terrorism that has swept the Arab and Muslim world in the 90s. This is an outsider's perspective.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands were senselessly killed over the decades. The pattern of justification is exactly the same. Deny that the perpetrators are on your side if the attack is hard to justify or vilify, or you can't vilify the victims. Of course, as you know, a healthy dose of religion was included. The meme I attached perfectly illustrates the latter points. Another talking point we haven't reached yet, I think, is the greater good. Some of the victims are innocent, but their deaths were necessary for the greater good. God will sort them out and reward them. When you start hearing this, you're officially in civil war. Another shocking part about it was the egregious friendliness of the police towards force to the vigilantes, the neo-Nazis. This didn't happen in the Arab world, but it did happen in Nazi Germany. The brown shirts were a volunteer militia. They're the ones who perpetrated Kristallnacht and other attacks with the unofficial blessing of law enforcement. This is a terrible sign for the future. I wish I had a silver lining to end, but I don't. And the meme is a picture of Kyle, but it's a picture of him, not him looking badass, but him just kind of looking dazed and confused, like, huh? And so you have a kind of ghost white Jesus over his shoulder.
Oh, yeah,
and
I saw this
Jesus
one.
Is like, you see that man over there? He is a pedo. That guy over there, he beats his girl. This other kid is not a medic. He's a burglar.
Yeah.
So it's like the voices in his head, meaning the ideology, all of the media he consumes. Mm-hmm. It's telling him that all the people in front of him are evil. Evildoers.
And
the enemy.
He is more justified in whatever he does to them.
Right. And that's the case with all reactionary politics. Justifying harm to others to protect yourself and what you have, whether it be privilege, wealth accumulated, so on and so forth, or lack of thereof, but the potential to accumulate wealth and power and be on top, the exploiter.
Well, if we're on the topic of the situation in Kenosha, I just wanted to bring up the meme that I made for the Green Party.
Oh, yes.
I made a meme with Squidward.
Squidward.
And it's like, fun facts with Squidward.
Squidward.
And the caption is, getting your mom to drive you in the firearm that you're too young to carry 60 miles specifically so you can shoot protesters makes you a domestic terrorist. And that meme spread like wildfire.
Is the mother isn't being charged with anything, is she?
Not to my knowledge, although
even though she kind of abetted in the crime, but
yeah,
you have to prove it was premeditated, but they went there to protect property.
And how else were they intending to protect property with a gun if not by
shooting
people?
Yes. Committing attempted murder.
Right, exactly. But that meme that's shared on the Upper Hudson Green Party's page has gotten 38,000 shares, 1,700 reactions on the page,
which is
a lot, and has single-handedly grown the page itself from, I want to say, around 800 likes to, holy crap, we're at 1,312 likes right now.
I hope all of them will phone bank for Howie.
Oh, me too. I hope so.
Or donate to the ballot initiative fund. We still have 5 more states. So here's an update for you that you never asked for, but to let you know that running for president is not some shell game. It is an actual, like, long haul kind of work thing that goes up even until the last month of even getting on the ballot.
Yeah.
So we have like 5 court orders right now trying to get back on the ballot in some states, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, who are trying to kick us off. Who's trying to kick us off? Democrats are trying to kick us off.
Of course.
This is something that's not said, that while others try entryism, you're basically siding with abusers because they abuse your so-called comrades or allies. You know, you should be on our side. Well, while we're not doing what you're doing, your little partners, potential partners over there, are banning us from elections.
Yeah.
They're making it harder for us to even participate as independents.
Yeah.
And you are okay with all of that because you are going to be entryist. You're going to be part of that party and say you're going to have your own caucus and be letting you get a little head pats of how like virtuous you are in being on the winning team. You know, and then it becomes team politics because then you get wrapped up in the we're Democrats and we need to support the Democrats. It's a trap. It's been done over and over and over again. And I'm surprised that it's people who aren't just new to politics that are falling for it, but people who have been in there and they've been doing that strategy and they still think that because, see, they get some small victories, they get some crumbs.
Yep.
I think someone actually mentioned in one comment thread that like the, but it was indivisible, had been like, getting all these gains and wins. And I'm like, what gains and wins? You mean that, like, I think it was in the Indivisible chapter here in our region. They were a group of progressive Democrats, and they used their law degrees, because they're all PMC,
right,
to get all of the immigrants who were detained in Albany County and another county jails out.
Oh.
So they're individually, case by case, able to get them out. And so they weren't sent to ICE.
Oh,
they were
awesome.
They were released into community programs and stuff. So it's like big win. We did it. We got them out of the cages. And it's like, but that strategy works here in our region, but not on the national level.
Right.
So there's kind of a difference of scales working here. When it comes to the nation and the global system. Your little like tit for tat, like we're going to use local law in our poll, like your influence ends at the county line.
Right.
Because you could be a big shot lawyer or a lawyer with some pull and clout. But once you're in state lobbying state government, you're a nobody.
Yeah.
And that's what I learned. Like there's you're not a somebody in the state legislative process unless you're donating millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And that's where it becomes plutocracy.
Yeah.
On the local level, it doesn't feel like plutocracy, even though money and changing hands and patronage is still there.
Right.
But it's also
not quite to the extent.
But there's more social capitalism happening too, of like, oh, you're friends with all of these people. You make friends at being in a certain position. This is how you climb the local governance ladder. And then you're assemblyman for like 30 years.
Right.
Something like that. And you
that's what my stepmom did.
Yeah, exactly. And your stepmom is not like murdering.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Reactionary. I'm sure there's a lot of good beliefs going on there about local government and helping people, you know, small businesses. Let's not let Walmart push us around.
Right.
Something like that. But that's like, it doesn't work on the national level. It has to be a completely different strategy.
Yeah.
You almost need like dual strategies of like nice compromising coalition building locally. And then when you get bigger, then it's like general strike. We need to like be on the same page about like we're resisting all of it, not collaborating.
Right.
Yeah. Which is interesting because then you kind of get into the bioregionalism or the kind of sort of nationalism of the region.
Right.
Of the state, and that's where balkanization and you know real partisanship, where it's New York versus
upstate,
even the city, city versus upstate, New York versus Sun Belt, Rust Belt versus Sun Belt, but that's there's more going on. I also wanted to mention I've been rewatching Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and we watched one of the episode called Bar Association, where a number of characters form a union and they strike. And it's kind of ham-fisted in its execution, but it's still pretty fun.
Have you seen the Facebook group Star Trek Comrade posting?
There's 10 Star Trek lefty groups.
Oh, really?
There's a particular guy named Will.
Oh, yeah, Will. Nguyen.
Nguyen. Yes, Will Nguyen. You know that it's a common Vietnamese last name.
Yeah.
You learn it from watching BoJack Horseman. You have Diane
Nguyen.
So it's Will Nguyen. And he has the full cosplay, red shirt.
Yep.
And it's becoming quite the symbol of ire for right wing Star Trek fans, which is so pop culture getting this in there is so like one of the leftist critiques of Star Trek lore is that, you know, you have the ships that are quite hierarchically managed.
Yeah.
And quite top down. And this is something that like is always like if there's a source of conflict in the show, it's that you have the Starfleet command of old stodgy admirals stuck and they're just sitting on Earth at desks. And you have the commanders in the field and they're dealing with actual problems.
Right.
And they're getting orders that are kind of not helpful. And the CBS animated show, which is kind of trying to pull in the Rick and Morty demographic, Lower Decks. I watched the first episode of that through my own means.
How is it? I haven't seen it yet.
So I think it has potential in subverting and critiquing and doing that critique, the leftist, left-leaning critique of like the hierarchies, because you have the kind of Rick character named Mariner, wink, wink, Mariner, who's featured in the ads and stuff. She's like the cool chick. We like the scrappy underdog because she has this, what do you call it, adversarial relationship with command.
Right.
She doesn't want to be commander. She doesn't want to raise, like, doesn't want, like, she doesn't see that kind of advancement. She wants to help people.
Right.
So the first episode is like, no, like, they're doing second contact. They're, like, doing the follow-up.
Right.
So that's where the jokes can happen. And she goes off protocol to help some farmers.
Okay.
Because she's in it to help people, even if it means, like, not following any rules.
Yeah.
So there's a lack of structure, discipline, etc. Things could go wrong, but she's willing to take those risks to like help the left out. That's the perspective she's coming at it. We'll see how it develops. It's mostly, of course, just like Rick and Morty humor.
Yeah.
Gross out, some swearing, pretty juvenile at times. Not that well developed, actually, but
a lot of bodily humor.
But they don't keep it close to the chest. They tell you right away that the captain of the ship she's on is her mother. And an admiral is her father. And so she's like she was forced into Starfleet.
Right.
But like she's what Jake could have been if Jake didn't, like another episode involves one of the captain's children in Deep Space Nine. He's like, you know, the father expects him to go to Starfleet Academy. And he's like, I don't want to go to Starfleet. But he's like, I don't want to tell him. He'll be mad.
Right.
And then he has to get learn the lesson of like, hey, my dad, you know, wanted me to be cellist. Anyway, I won't go into it.
My dad wanted me to play football.
Is that true?
It is. And I did play a little bit of football. And
you do have the frame for it.
Yeah, but I was terrible at it. Like, I can't throw. I can't catch. And
can you run?
Not well. I have asthma.
So you're not left eye at all?
Nah. I'm not built for... Well, I'm... shaped for sports, but internally I'm not built for sports.
Gotcha. Okay, so we've hit half an hour in, which is great timing.
Awesome.
So I'm gonna hand it over to Mike Walsh, co-host here, and he wanted to, and we're gonna enjoy it, and he'll comment as we go. Or do you want to wait until you're done reading it?
Feel free to interrupt me at any point.
Now a dramatic reading of the first chapter of Conquest of Bread by Peter Kropotkin, also known as The Bread Book. So this is the first chapter is kind of the introduction of like the crisis, the problem. And of course, this is written in, what was the year?
I want to say late 1800s.
Well, 1889, 1890s. So it was in the 1890s. For some reason, there are these decades left out of American history. I wonder why. Because they're the decades where there were recessions happening.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, nothing cool was happening. But it's also everyone was suffering. So this was that kind of time.
Well, before I want to skip the, the preface, because, it's just context.
Gotcha.
And you get the context from the year. It's an old book, and it's a really good book. But when I open the first page, there's a little thing, and it says, "This book is in the public domain. I looked around and only found copies that cost more than they should, so I decided to publish it as cheaply as possible. You won't find a cheaper new copy anywhere, because I make no profit. The entire purchase price goes to printing and distribution. Now,
at cost.
Wholesale.
I like that.
Yes.
Except, unfortunately, I did buy this book on Amazon. I feel a little bad as because of that.
You should.
But
wasn't there a direct publisher then?
That I could find. But I will say that I think about it from the perspectives that the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will use to hang them. And that's how I'm like, all right, getting theory from Amazon is not the worst thing. Like, it's one of the better things to be getting from Amazon.
Unless we actually do kind of go beyond credit scores and have social credit scores where it's like, oh, you were at a protest.
Right, yeah.
We're not going to sell you this wood.
Yeah. Well, the human race has traveled far since those bygone age when men used to fashion their rude implements of flint and lived on the precarious soils of the chase, leaving to their children for their only heritage a shelter beneath the rocks, some poor utensils, and nature, vast, ununderstood, and terrific, with whom they had to fight for their wretched existence. During the agitated times which have elapsed since...
That's kind of a Hobbesian point of view, isn't it?
Well, which have lasted for many thousands of years, mankind has nevertheless amassed untold treasures. It has cleared the land, dried the marshes, pierced the forests, made roads. It has been building, inventing, observing, reasoning. It has created a complex machinery, wrested her secrets from nature, and finally, it has made a servant of steam. Which, well, it's kind of quaint.
Hot tech then.
That
would be nanotech.
Fresh technology.
Yes.
And the result is now the child of the civilized man finds ready at its birth to his hand an immense capital accumulated by those who have gone before him. And this capital enables him to acquire, merely by his own labor, combined with the labors of others, riches surpassing the dreams of the Orient, expressed in the fairy tales of 1001 Nights. The soil is cleared to make great extent, fit for the reception of the best needs, ready to make a rich return for the skill and labor spent upon it, a return more than sufficient for all the wants of humanity. The methods of cultivation are known. On the wide prairies of America, each 100 men, with the aid of powerful machinery, can produce in a few months enough wheat to maintain 10,000 people for a whole year. And where man wishes to double his produce, to treble it, to multiply it 100-fold, he makes the soil, gives to each plant the requisite care, and thus obtains enormous results. When the hunter of old had to scour 50 or 60 square miles to find food for his family, the civilized man supports his household with far less pains and far more certainty on the 1,000th part of that space.
So I'll point out a few things that come to mind. There's the thought of during the Victorian era, there was a massive population boom from industrialization and the results of that industrialization, which included access to natural fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that the British colonial empire did was there would be these islands off the South American coast and elsewhere. They were completely made of bird droppings.
Guano.
Yes. And they would have workers work them to death collecting it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the first, green revolution of multiplying by many times included basically what he's describing, though, and this is where the ecology angle needs to be put in from fast forward to our, future generations. Putting in the ecology angle and the analysis of like this, the boom that he's talking about, the advances were based on the extraction of resources from nature and not really giving them back, because using the nitrogen from the guano to nitrogen fix to grow so much more food, it really wasn't put back in any way.
Yeah.
It was, because you're moving it from one continent to another.
Right.
Though the guano was just sitting there, and that's why there was a gigantic mountain. Mountain of it, shipping in, moving in with the workers. They maybe had a cloth mask, but it was the smell. They would die in 5 years or something. Yeah, but that was from my Environmental History of South America book that I took class in, among other things. So continue.
Well, climate is no longer an obstacle. When the sun fails, man replaces it by artificial heat. And we see the coming of a time when artificial light will also be used to stimulate vegetation. The time is now. Meanwhile, by the use of glass and hot water pipes, man renders a given space 10 and 50 times more productive than it was in its natural state. The prodigies accomplished in industry are still more striking.
I think he's talking about greenhouses there.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. With the cooperation of those intelligent beings, the modern machines themselves, the fruit of three or four generations of inventors, mostly unknown, 100 men manufacture now the stuff to close 10,000 persons for a period of 2 years. In well-managed coal mines, the labor of 100 miners furnishes each year enough fuel to warm 10,000 families under an inclement sky. And we have witnessed twice the spectacle of a wonderful city springing up in a few months at Paris without interrupting in the slightest degree the regular work of the French nation. And if in manufacturers, as in agriculture, and as indeed through our whole social system, the labor, the discoveries, and the inventions of our ancestors profit chiefly the few, it is none the certain that mankind in general, aided by the creatures of steel and iron which it already possesses, could already procure an existence of wealth and ease for every one of its members. Truly, we are rich, far richer than we think, rich in what we already possess, richer still in the possibilities of production of our actual mechanical outfit, richest of all in what we might win from our soil, from our manufacturers, from our science, from our technical knowledge, were they but applied to bringing about the well-being of all. Chapter 1, Part 2. We in civilized societies are rich. Why, then, are the many poor? Why this painful drudgery for the masses? Why, even to the best-paid workmen, this uncertainty for the morrow? In the midst of all the wealth inherited from the past, and in spite of the powerful means of production, which could ensure comfort to all in return for a few hours of daily toil. The socialists have said it and repeated it unwaringly. Daily they reiterate it, and demonstrating it by arguments taken from all the sciences. It's because all that is necessary for production, the land, the mines, the highways, machinery, food, shelter, education, knowledge, all have been seized by the few in the course of that long story of robbery, enforced migration and wars, of ignorance and oppression, which has been the life of the human race before it has learned to subdue the forces of nature. It is because taking advantage of alleged rights acquired in the past, those few appropriate today 2/3 of the products of human labor, and then squander them in the most stupid and shameful way. It is because, having reduced the masses to a point at which they have not the means of subsistence for a month, or even for a week in advance, the few only allow the many to work on condition of themselves receiving the lion's share. It is because these few prevent the remainder of men from producing the things they need, and force them to produce not the necessities of life for all, but whatever offers the greatest profits to the monopolist. And this is the substance of all socialism.
So, like, the discussion of the last few paragraphs was, we create surplus industrialization, and since the Renaissance, we've been building surpluses.
Yeah.
What do we do with those surpluses then? Well, because of the hierarchies of the Middle Ages.
Oh, of course.
You know, the presumed rights, as he puts it, or the alleged rights, the rights of kings, because they have monopoly of violence.
Yeah.
And that monopoly of violence carries through and then becomes a monopoly of capital.
Mm-hmm.
In which they granted the right, the presumed rights of people to extract resources. To say, this lord, you own all this, surplus goes to you.
Right.
And then they become the industrialists eventually.
Yeah.
Or they hire the engineers who then become the next generation of industrialists. And so on and so on. We get to that part of the industrial age where you have the vast surpluses. They're made for market exchange, not use.
Right.
And that's kind of one of those things that in future chapters he kind of discusses, I believe.
I think so.
As well as other thinkers of his day. Like, the first half of the Bread Book is kind of the overview of what a lot of other lefty writers of the day did, which was just discuss that we have all this surplus.
Yeah.
And we're just using it for market exchange, meaning selling on the market. Whoever will buy it for the most. Or sell for the least, versus distributing it to actually, like,
right,
100 people can clothe 10,000. Why isn't everyone getting all the clothes? Why is it only
right.
this middle class or the bourgeoisie or the, you know, minority getting
yeah.
these clothes? Truly, isn't really enough clothes for everyone? Well, you say, like, well, isn't enough, like, even today? Isn't enough being made? Aren't enough sneakers being made for everyone? Well, yes, but only what can be sold. And since only so many can actually buy them, there is a huge amount of the surplus of all kinds of goods. Food, 40% is thrown out. And that goes for clothes. Half of it is probably going to the dumpster eventually.
Yeah.
Or, you know, gets worn out because it's cheaply made. So the clothes are made, but they're made so poorly. And that goes for our infrastructure and everything else. And so, like, the building up of the surplus and all of, like, the centuries of work. I wonder about, like, our future in this century where we have all of this infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
but it's falling apart. We basically have to rebuild it
yeah.
for on the trillions. When does the turning happen? Or is, like, is this the... It's likely not, but, like, the turning of the train is moving. We can't do something else. We just have to keep building surpluses onto the other surpluses.
Right.
If we fix up our infrastructure to the A rating, we're really just kind of fixing what was already built. But yeah. it's like so much of the infrastructure of the industrial era and the ruins are all scattered around New York. And it's like you're basically rebuilding it. You're not building off of what's already there.
Right.
I mean, some kind of rehabs and rehabilitation can occur. But when it comes to brown sites, you're basically just trying to fix the harm that was caused.
Yeah.
But that's also one of those principles of good design where you pick the area that is the most
yeah.
harm done to it or the least beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you build.
Yeah.
Like, you build on the brown site, not on the green field.
Mm-hmm.
Greenfield referring to, say, the meadows of the suburbia.
Yeah.
Where the good land, that's the good price, or the cheaper land is.
Yeah.
Because the brownfield is going to cost more because you have to pay the rehab it.
Yeah.
But that's market pricing is concerned, not need. The need is to build there.
Yeah. Well, right. Take indeed a civilized country. The forests which once covered it have been cleared. The marshes drained. The climate improved. It has been made habitable. The soil, which bore formerly only a coarse vegetation, is covered today with rich harvests. The rock walls in the valleys are laid out in terraces and covered with vines bearing golden fruit. The wild plants, which yielded naught but acrid berries or uneatable roots, have been transformed by generations of culture into succulent vegetables, or trees covered with delicious fruits. Thousands of highways and railroads furrow the earth and pierce the mountains. The shriek of the engine is heard in the wild gorges of the Alps, the Caucasus, and the Himalayas. The rivers have been made navigable. The coasts, carefully surveyed, are easy of access. Artificial harbors, laboriously dug out and protected against the fury of the sea, afford shelter to the ships. Deep shafts have been dug in the rocks. Labyrinths of underground galleries have been dug out where coal may be raised or minerals extracted. At the crossing of the highways, great cities have sprung up, and within their borders, all the treasures of industry, science, and art have been accumulated. Whole generations that lived and died in misery, oppressed and ill-treated by their masters, and worn out by toil, have handed on this immense inheritance to our century. For thousands of years, millions of men have labored to clear the forests, to drain the marshes, to open the highways by land and water. Every rood of soil we cultivate in Europe, or anywhere else, has been watered by the sweat of several races of men. Every acre...
Races.
Every acre has its story of enforced labor, of intolerable toil, of the people's sufferings. Every mile of highway, every yard of tunnel, has received its share of human blood. The shafts of the mine still bear on their rocky walls the marks made by the pick of the workmen who toiled to excavate them. The space between each prop in the underground galleries might be marked as a miner's grave, and who can tell what each of these graves has cost in tears and privations and unspeakable wretchedness to the family who depend on the scanty wage of the worker cut off in his prime by the fire damp, rockfall, or flood. The cities, bound together by railroads and waterways, are organisms which have lived through the centuries. Dig beneath them and you find, one above another, the formations of streets, the houses or theaters or public buildings. Search into their history and you will see how the civilization of the town, its industry, its special characteristics, have slowly grown and ripened through the cooperation of generations of its inhabitants before it could become what it is today. And even today, the value of each dwelling, factory, and warehouse which has been created by the accumulated labor of millions of workers, now dead and buried, is only maintained by the very presence of labor of regions of the men who now inhabit that special corner of the globe. Each of the atoms composing what we call the wealth of nations owes its value to the fact that it is part of the great whole. What would a London dockyard or a great Paris warehouse be if they were not situated in these great centers of international commerce? What would become of our mines, our factories, our workshops, and our railways without the immense quantities of merchandise transported every day by sea and land? Millions of human beings have labored to create the civilization which we pride ourselves today. Other millions scattered through the globe labor to maintain it. Without them, nothing would be left in 50 years but ruins. There is not even a thought or an invention which is not common property, born of the past and the present. Thousands of inventors, known and unknown, have died in poverty, have cooperated with the inventions of each of these machines which embody the genius of man. Thousands of writers, of poets, of scholars, have labored to increase knowledge, to dissipate error, and to create that atmosphere of scientific thought, without which the marvels of our century could not have appeared. And these thousands of philosophers, of poets, of scholars, of inventors, have themselves been supported by the labor of past centuries. They have been upheld and nourished through life, both physically and mentally, by legions of workers and craftsmen of all sorts. They have drawn their motive force from the environment. The genius of a Seguin, a Mayer, a Grove, has certainly done more to launch industry in a new direction than all the capitalists in the world.
How much more is there?
There's like two pages left in the chapter, but we're... Okay. Got a little bit done in this part.
Yeah.
I guess the central thesis of this chapter, I would say, is that all men, or all of humanity, labored to create the civilization which we live in today. And because of that, all people, all of humanity, deserves to reap the reward of living in the society that was created by them.
Yeah, it's the kind of innate argument for common ownership.
Yeah, and exactly.
The questions of, like, and the strategies, tendencies of socialism, however forms they take, and we've discussed some of them, is how to do common ownership. Like, yeah. Especially coming off of what we have now. So we have states. So common ownership is done through a state. Seems reasonable enough, but then you have top-down bureaucracy. Especially with modern nation states, which exist because of bureaucracy, or the bureaucracy exists to handle market economies and stuff like that. So there's, you know, complaints of bureaucracy, especially since bureaucracy was created by the private sector,
right?
By business, is always kind of funny that, you know, bureaucracy is, you know, we hate it when it's corporations, we hate it when it's government, but it's also necessary for the civilization we have.
Yeah.
As everything that we have was at one point necessary due to the civilization we have. Then there's the general sentiment that's, you know, he says again and again, which is everyone helped make it in a macro sense.
Yeah.
And that includes people who are quote unquote lazy or not doing the X work. I mean, it becomes such a splitting of hairs.
Yeah.
To decide and to have criteria for who was the valuable contributor, who was the person who did the most, like the robber barons or the heroes of the industry, you know, Tesla versus Edison.
Yeah.
Who was more important? One was certainly
Edison's employees, or
yes,
were probably the
most 20 people important. That were experimenting with him, but
the
also
the person who actually invented, yes, the light bulb,
right,
not Edison.
And we don't know their name. Their name isn't, right, put up in memorials because they weren't the industrialist business mogul, and neither was Tesla. And that's why Tesla has to be drudged up by nerd culture to,
yeah,
be a household name. Or by, you know, Musk, who's like, you know, a weeb of his own type.
Yeah.
And yeah, to name his company after it, which is just funny as hell, considering Tesla.
He's an Edison.
And Tesla, like, right, yeah, exactly. Though Edison, I don't think, was make his money from public subsidy.
No.
But that's the difference between the neoliberal economy,
oh, yeah,
and the industrial economy.
Of course.
So, but whatever. So, and the same goes, like he mentions, not so much copyright, but invention and innovation,
yeah,
which isn't something to be owned by one person, since most people who actually do the innovating are not compensated for it.
Yeah.
At all.
It's,
necessity
it's
is a mother
who
of invention.
Own the labor of the person who did the inventing that gets to reap the reward of the invention.
Yes. Pieces of paper, being in the right place at the right time, having the ability to invest. Kind of like those entrepreneurs who basically price gouge PPE equipment,
right,
or hand sanitizer. They seem to have the thousands of dollars around to basically buy up all the stock in all,
yeah,
the stores in their region so they could resell all of it five times the price on eBay. They had the opportunity to do that.
Right.
Opportunity cost is a thing. Freakonomics even talks about it. And that's apparently something that's the fairness of the market at some end of the day, because the people who have the opportunity cost are the people who apparently worked hard to get it,
right,
which after maybe 20 years of hard labor, maybe of saving, but you have certain things have to be going well for you,
right,
and that's what privilege is, the ability to not be stressed out and feel for that you would have a family member killed by the police or something.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have these unforeseen costs that basically sink your savings, if you can even have savings,
right,
which as things develop, as the crisis deepens and rents go up or evictions, blah, 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 it, you know, so on, so on. So do you want to keep going with that, or do you have more thoughts to summarize the rest,
yeah,
of it?
I think we had a good combo. Like, it's more about triggering us and getting ideas for us to talk about.
Yeah, because when I read pretty much all of it, though,
yeah,
I forget most of it. What I do remember more so, because maybe my brain focused on it because it was what I needed more of at the time, was in later chapters he kind of discusses, it's called Conquest of Bread, because,
right,
like, if you're going to do revolution or social change, you need the support of farmers, you need surplus of your own,
right,
to do things. And that means urban workers need to, and this is written like after the Paris Commune.
Yeah.
And the different
That's
problem there is
one.
Paris was besieged by the army and everyone was starving. Everyone was starving and eating rats or whatever. And so, like, you need to make deals with farmers or coalition with them so that you have food.
Right.
And then he goes in other chapters about, like, how would things work during the particularly anarchistic revolution.
Right.
So, like, sort of the commune, syndicalist in nature,
mm-hmm,
not just... So, this is, like, the conquest of bread strategy is circumvented by, say, the Bolsheviks, who take state power, and then from their central position, kind of like Napoleon, you control the central position, and then you can counter threats as they come.
Right.
Because you have that base that the state commands, or does command.
Well, a lot of what...
And then monopoly of violence kind of is your first and foremost, that capital. And then you build the financial capital of,
yeah,
the surplus. And then... As Stalin did, to get his own victory, you build the social capital of having all the friends.
Right.
So yeah. It's like those three steps we kind of need to think about.
Well, a lot more of what The Conquest of Bread talks about, it, he goes into it a lot when discussing food, is that the revolution...
Food, please.
The revolution needs food. The people carrying out the revolution need to be fed. So I think that's where the name The Conquest of Bread comes from. In one of the later chapters on food, he talks about how the Paris Commune fell because the people weren't fed properly, and they were happy for the commune to end and for the existing power to come back because they were hungry. They wanted food. You have to feed a revolution. And if you have finished this book or you are interested more, there is a great book by Rocker, Anarcho-Syndicalist Theory in Practice, which talks about it's
more recent.
It's a lot of the
same.
Was
it written in the 30s, 40s, or
interwar? Yeah, it was written, I think, well, it was written after the Spanish Civil War, because it talks almost entirely
about
Catalonia. Yep, and the CNT. And how the CNT and the Catalonia had a revolution, and they followed the guide of the Conquest of Bread. Mm-hmm. They followed what Kropotkin said. And as a result, their revolution was pretty classless.
It was working.
Pretty awesome.
But then they lost the war.
Well, it was working up until the fascists invaded.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they had to fight a large war. And
yeah, they were in the middle of the Spanish Civil War.
It was just one region, so they didn't have the capacity do it. I mean, it's just simple, like, numbers.
Actually, it wasn't just the fascists. It was also
the Republicans,
and the Soviets and the communists.
Yeah, it's complicated, but yes.
Yeah.
It was besieged on all sides, and they didn't have a central position. They didn't have a base of violence to use.
No,
to
they just
themselves.
Had... They weren't a thing. They were just an area that the people have decided, no more rulers, we're going to do our own thing. And if there is anyone who is calling the shots, it's the labor unions.
And so they did have industrial capacity, but like converting it to a war economy and all that stuff is something that Rojava's probably learned from.
Yeah.
And trying to do their own way. But again, they have an industrial resource base from the oil fields, where then they get called U.S. puppets because they're selling it through U.S. companies, making deals that way instead of Assad, because that would be giving up their autonomy.
Yeah.
And it's interesting the kind of side you have to take when, say, you are just a little region.
Right.
But that's kind of where it has to happen. It's not going to be a whole state unless you take the whole state over, and then you're basically the villains.
Exactly.
Which is kind of this video about, in the last few minutes, like Che versus Fidel. They're both seriously important. They're both the good guys as far as our point of view is concerned.
Right.
But one is a martyr because he died young and was pure. And the other was a stuffy bureaucrat who's authoritarian because he succeeded and had the president of the state and could defend that state, the people and the benefits that they were getting. It's because he did have popular support and still does. But Fidel doesn't have his face on capitalist merchandise.
Right, yeah.
Which is, kind of tells you something. So it's like in the left, the U.S., the left kind of likes losing. We like the losers, the underdogs, scrappy underdogs. It's like resistance for its own sake, activism or protest for its own sake. Trying to get out of that headspace towards the organizing methodology. We're actually going to defend what's ours. And if people and liberals don't like it, then they're kind of on their own.
Yeah.
Like, even with North Korea, it's like they're hated and they're bad because they're actually able to act independently.
Yeah.
And that's the greatest crime of all as far as U.S. empire is concerned. It's an interesting point of view to look at that, you know, just consider it. The ability to defend yourself, to have your own, quote unquote, or act outside the monopoly of violence that the U.S. has in the world. Because they don't need to ask for permission to go to war. They act like they do. But that was thrown away in 2003.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, this has been the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, with Michael Walsh. I'm doing leftist reading and analysis talk radio here at Grant Street Community Arts. We have a pledge drive coming up. Please become a member, grandarts.org. There is a big donate button. And so please support the station and our bills. We don't have taxes. The building is ours. But otherwise, we have operations to do and programs that we want to fund and expand our reach. So thank you very much. And we'll be back on the second hour with some more strategy talk.
They got cops on the streets, walking in lines with taser guns, wooden batons, trying to keep you scared with violent attacks. You know it all comes down to how you react, and now you're face to face, seeing it all. Dispersed the warnings and making the call. They got busted the pack with people like you, and they did that in the 50s. The movement grew. Young student, new to the game, movement elder, fan of the flames, combat veteran, seen it before. Same tactics used in the foreign war. Find a war, and you're keeping your ground. Committed people sitting all around through the bullhorn. It's all distorted. You can't leave now. We can't afford it. Hold the line. Even if your voice shakes, friend of mine. Even if your voice shakes, push forward. It's up to you. See it through. Silence breaks, voices are loud, rubber bullets crack, pierce the crowd, heart starts pumping, scared but proud, because the people still sitting in the tear gas cloud. The line advances, they're swinging sticks, hear the marching boots and the taser clicks, screaming erupts, someone got struck, people calling for a medic, they better hurry up, now the vomit comes like a flood, getting choked by the gas, hands covered in blood, bruised and beaten, limping away, remember it's always been this way, they'll beat you down, show you the guns, it gets violent sometimes, and then change comes, you stand firm, organize, and then come back. Too many people for them to attack. You gotta hold the line. Even if your voice shakes, friend of mine. Even if your voice shakes, push forward. It's up to you. See it through. And it's days like this when something clicks, when you're confused, tired, and scared as shit. Body's alive with that heartfelt driving. You engage the problem right before you ride. When you could have ran, but you stayed inside. When you were beaten and gassed, and you still came back. That feeling of power that you got deep down rises to the top. When you get beat down, there's a world to win. When your heart is strong and a dozen new wrongs to focus on. Every day brings a vision to strive for. Something to live and die for. And when you go back home and you're on your own, it's easy to feel like you're all alone. But it's through memory and hope that we stay supported. Because we can't quit now. We can't afford it. Hold the line. Shakes, friend of mine. Even if your voice shakes, push forward. It's up to you. See it through.
Okay, and we're back to the Three Left Show. We are the trolley problem made manifest. And leaving the rat race for the rat sitting. So we're going to talk about Nazi punching, I guess, but also like strategy and tactics in the public sphere.
Okay.
So a lot of it is probably being, it could be thrown out the window, but it's debates that we're constantly having on the left, especially when faced with the difficulties and the realities of right-wing paramilitaries actively being able to kill us if we go out protesting and actively resisting, or for even for its own sake. But let's say there's an actual point to it. We could be opposed not just by police, who maybe have the restraint of using non-lethal gas rounds and shooting rubber bullets that can break the skin.
Exactly.
I've seen some gnarly pictures.
Yeah.
Flashbangs and the like, which are really scary when they go off like even a block away from you. Like, they're freaking loud, and they're like, it's not like Call of Duty, okay? When you toss that flashbang, it's like, you know, it's big. But here's a kind of pseudo debate between two different sources. One is, it's an article published by the Department of History of the University of Sheffield. Okay. So this is in Britain, and it's about a particular event. So the question is, like, to resist Nazis or neo-Nazis,
yeah,
or the proto-fascists. Like the question that liberals and others kind of bring up, or the liberal influenced, like, you're just giving them attention. You're making them martyrs and victims. You're only feeding their victim complex. And this is going to help them later. So here's an article that kind of actually expresses that a bit.
Okay.
It's from Why We're Learning the Wrong Lessons from Cable Street All These Years. On a Sunday in early October, a crowd of over 100,000 protesters massed in the streets of London to prevent a column of 3,000 or so black-shirted members of Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists from marching to celebrate the anniversary of their movement's establishment. Around 6,000 police officers attempted forcibly to clear a path for the march, but met with violent resistance from the anti-fascist crowd, who threw missiles and erected barricades, leading to 113 arrests. Even if you didn't already know the subject of the blog, your answer would probably be the Battle of Cable Street. You would, however, be wrong. The event described took place a year later and just 1 mile away in Bermondsey. The battles of Cable Street and Bermondsey were in many regards almost identical. All the details listed above apply to both. Now, they also, of course, could be describing what happens in Portland.
Yeah.
Or in D.C. going onward. Yeah. This reflects the fact that Bermondsey was actually even more violent, with communist mouthpiece and the Daily Worker claiming that the anti-fascist crowd was larger than a year earlier and that London was not witnessed such a bitter street fighting for years. So why was Bermondsey, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, been almost entirely forgotten, whereas Cable Street remains so deeply imprinted in collective British memory? In large part because the fact that that place even happened conflicts with the mythologized memory of Cable Street, which holds that the 4th of October 1936 marked, in words of anti-fascist activist Morris Beckman, a watershed event that had a devastating effect on the fascists. It was the very moment the tide began to recede. Never again did the fascists attempt such a march. So to put then our contemporary context, you have Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally, seriously and well opposed by Antifa, like my friends of mine. And I went to the anniversary after the fact. I wasn't there the first time. But the second time, which was also at D.C., the right-wing crowd shrank immensely. Wynne has been taken out. Their moment is sort of over. You even have Richard Spencer now come out saying the moment their moment is over. They need to go to the back burner. He has endorsed
Biden. Yeah,
he's riding with Biden, the white nationalist Richard Spencer. So funny, right?
Yeah,
it's so funny because that is the mental gymnastics you do when you don't have your own organization. That's the way I see it, anyway. The fact that I'm a green means I never have to play that game of what is the strategy I use while I don't have my own power. I'd rather at least pretend, or like, okay, maybe I could potentially have my own power because I have my own org. I have written elsewhere, the aftermath of Cable Street saw a huge wave of new members join the fascist East End branches. At local elections in March and October the following year, black shirt candidates received thousands of votes in East London. Worst of all, Cable Street was used by the Fash as the basis for a significant escalation of their viciously anti-Semitic propaganda campaign, while physical violence against Jews also increased. In fact, this had been precisely their plan when organizing the 4th of October. The fascists were fully aware that they would be hugely outnumbered. I thought that's not just a Trump word, hugely outnumbered by their opponents, and actually hoped for aggressive disruption of the event, as it would provide much-needed publicity for a dying movement and play perfectly into Mosley's carefully cultivated image of victimhood. Now, I want to point out that this is said over and over again, even today, about Richard Spencer and his movement. But it's like, how much of that is projection? You're saying that it fits into their plans. Maybe they're saying that, but like, we could also believe that their plans are really dumb. They think they're going to get all this public sympathy by being punched by Antifa. But how much of that actually translates to new membership and actual political power? I would argue it doesn't. But they all say it does. And if they all say it enough, they believe it and it's real for them. Anyway, However, if we are to learn from history, understanding the true course of events is vital in order to draw appropriate lessons. This is especially important with regard to Cable Street because memory of the battle is not just they celebrated, but also functional, used to inform and inspire today's struggle against the xenophobic far right. In particular, it has left the impression that the best way to defeat fascism is through mass protest and physical confrontation. Thus, we see Unite Against Fascism describing Cable Street as the turning point in the struggle against fascism. Unite Against Fascism is, I guess, today's big Antifa org in Britain. That can inform how we defeat the growing threat of the English Defense League, or anti-racism campaigner Kumar Murjdid speaking to East End residents about the struggle against them, declaring that we've fought the fascists on the streets in the past, and in our unity and our numbers will demonstrate yet again that no fascist of any kind is going to come to the streets of London. It should be noted that nonviolent mass demonstrations against fascism do have a place. In particular, they can be useful in a display of the scale of opposition to a rising extremist movement, and in provoking such a movement to reveal its true nature. So when they actually like strike back and they're the ones throwing punches. In fact, it is, in the case of today, shooting first, shooting their assault rifles.
Yeah.
Antifa isn't out there shooting people. We've never done that.
Antifa's never killed anyone except for ISIS fighters in the Middle East.
I mean, there are two instances of, I think, manslaughter or like serious assaults, but it's two instances.
Yeah.
They weren't fatalities. So, yes, we haven't killed anyone. And I'm putting a we there.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Jewish anti-fascist organizations have been involved in organizing the Cable Street demonstrations, such as the Jewish People's Council. This is going back to the interwar period.
Yeah.
Acknowledge that the event had led, in their words, to the intensification of fascist Jew baiting and terrorism. They therefore also started to move away from confrontation and sought increasingly to coordinate their efforts with the more conservative official Jewish communal leadership. Thus, from 1938, British Jewry was able to rally behind a unified approach to British fascism, which focused on intelligence gathering, which Antifa does, including infiltrating their orgs, working alongside the authorities to restrict fascist activity, and producing counter-propaganda, which is kind of the response you get from liberal and progressive circles today. The growing cohesion and moderation of Britain's diverse anti-fascist forces helped to starve the fascists of the conflict they desired to squeeze the political space available to them. While such methods may be far less dramatic and inspiring than the type of street activism represented in street battles, they offer the true lesson that should today be drawn from the successful struggle against fascism in the 30s, and thus today.
Yeah.
So that's that argument. That you starve them of attention and the conflict that they crave, and this kind of starves them of new members or media attention. So that's that argument. Now for a rebuttal, which includes also talking about the results of the interwar period. Because you could, so the argument, which I probably put in other forms in America, in other arguments, which I want to stress, which eventually is just one big meta-argument against entryism, working with authorities and the status quo. So you say, like, okay, Mosley was starved of attention by working with authorities. What did that lead to?
Yeah.
So, like, you start working with more moderates. You build a broad coalition, as progressives keep talking about. Even those, like, the populists, like Katie Bell and Sanger, oh, we need to work with populist right-wingers.
Mm.
What is that? Okay. So here is from libcom.org.
Ooh.
Libcom stands for Libertarian Communists.
Ooh.
Which I sometimes identify as, but not, it's kind of either really specific or right. You can just use it as a broad, like,
yeah,
you want communism, and but you don't want it to be through state bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Sort of syndicalist. A critical examination of the concept. So this is in the context that it's called Freedom of Speech, a Libertarian Perspective. Since free speech rights and right to protest and all that stuff fall into the don't punch a Nazi, that's taking their free speech away.
Mm.
And this is a general rebuttal to all of that. It's two related attitudes of free speech have become increasingly common. One is that we might call an absolutist position, where any claim to freedom of speech, however vague or abstract, is treated as being important, with any possible objection being automatically discredited in advance, like saying we should ban Nazi speech.
Right.
Or make sure Nazis cannot speak freely in public spaces. Deplatforming. Crazy SJWs.
Yeah.
In response, many on the left have come to adopt an increasingly cynical and mocking attitude to the whole concept, where some liberals seem to see any vague invocations of free speech as inherently worthwhile. Some leftists seem to view any appeal to free speech as being automatically suspect and worthy of ridicule. I'm not convinced that either position is particularly helpful for people who are, in fact, concerned with freedom. I'm sure I totally agree with that. So what is the third position that could be taken
right. In
the culture war? In practice, one of the big problems with free speech rhetoric is that while free speech tends to be invoked as an abstract good, any given controversy over any actually existing speech in the real world act will usually not just be about the act of the speech, but also the resources used to amplify that speech. So material conditions, materialism kind of comes in.
Right.
Not just the abstract, but my free speech.
Yeah.
So this means that quote-unquote free speech is, as a principle, is not much use as a guide to settling any particular dispute. As to use it in the way its advocates seem to suggest would be to assert that anyone should be able to use any space or resource they want, however and whenever they want. It's hard to say how that principle might apply in a society based around free access to resources, like the one we might fight for, what we do fight for, but it's certainly a widely inadequate one for navigating conflicts in a capitalist society based around private property and scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever tried buying a billboard? Ain't cheap. As this is all pitched at a fairly abstract level, it's worth taking a look at a few practical examples, all of which could, if you wish, be described as violating someone's freedom of speech. In 1984, an issue of The Sun had to appear with a hastily altered front page after workers refused to print a proposed headline attacking Arthur Sargill and striking miners. So it was like the Post, Washington Post, attacking, like, with an anti-worker headline, and the workers printing it didn't refuse to print it.
Right.
In 2010, although the threat wasn't carried out, BBC staff threatened to strike during the Conservative Party conference, meaning that no BBC coverage of the event would be broadcast. Around the same time, there were reports of postal workers refusing to deliver election leaflets for the British National Party.
Ooh.
In each case, it could be said that free speech was being suppressed, but it's worth considering the alternative. If print, television, or post workers decide they don't want to do the work necessary to amplify the speech of newspaper owners or politicians, then to insist on a right to speech that trumps their decision is essentially to say that these people should be forced to print, broadcast, or deliver things against their will. The supposedly freedom-loving position ends up with the deeply authoritarian idea that people shouldn't be allowed to decide what to do with their own bodies.
Yeah.
A lot of right-wing politics falls under this contradiction.
Yeah.
While these cases might be particularly clear-cut, a similar issue can be said to apply in the most common conflicts that take place around speakers at universities. So we're bringing it back down to the deplatforming of speakers at by SJW blue-haired university students, which are our friends. Okay, in these cases, a speaker can amplify their ideas by associating them with the prestige of a particular institution. These institutions and their reputations have been built by the work of those staff and students who keep them running. Wow, that sounds right, just like what you just read from the Bread Book. The reputation of universities are built by the work of students.
Yeah.
Not administrators.
Or students and professors, I'd say.
Yeah. Who keep it running just in the same way as newspapers are dependent on the work of printers. In the case of, say, a dispute over whether a particular speaker should be invited to speak at Oxford, to assert free speech as a guiding principle would essentially be to say that everyone should speak at Oxford, which I'm not sure anyone truly believes. I've never been invited to address an audience at Oxford, and the odds are that you haven't either, and no one seems to be too scandalized about that. In which case, if me and you are not speaking at Oxford, isn't it a shocking infringement on free speech, then it's hard to see how Marie Le Pen or Steve Bannon not doing the same thing is any different to be disinvited or to not be invited to speak.
Yeah.
If we believe that, say, healthcare or housing is a right, then that is to say that no one should ever be able to make a decision about whether someone else has access to him, to these things. In contrast, the free speech position in controversies over who gets to speak at Oxford doesn't claim that no one should ever be making decisions about who does and doesn't get to speak. Instead, there's a disagreement, and this is the important thing to understand, a disagreement over who gets to make those decisions, with the ostensibly free speech side, the absolutist side, favoring decisions being made by a relatively small number of people behind closed doors and with no right of appeal, while the allegedly authoritarian protesters demanding that this or that speaker be denied are requesting broader and more involvement in these decisions. Again, we see libertarian-sounding rhetoric about free speech hiding authoritarian and elitist assumptions, while the position of those demanding no platform points in the direction of students and workers being more involved in decision-making on campus, that is currently maintained or reproduced. So this, to me, is the neoliberal worldview kind of in a nutshell, that the politicians, the neoliberals, the Democrats that we are electing, they know better. They are professional politicians. And it carries through the entire society, whether it be administrators, bureaucrats. It's like, you're dumb.
Yeah.
And democracy is dangerous because you're all dumb, but professionals are less dumb and they can manage things. Let them take care of it. Neoliberalism is the holding up of the PMC, professional managerial class, as the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as local voters go, that's who votes.
Yeah.
That's who the base of the Democratic Party has been. And that's why Biden, even when, like, if everyone else is suppressed and they're coming out to vote because they can afford protective gear or driving to the polls or whatever, they're going to vote for the moderate.
Yeah.
The person who feels good and knows better, and not person representing populist policy.
Right.
Another area where free speech might be invoked, but turns out to be of little practical use, the controversies over content hosted on various internet platforms. Here, the relevant thing to consider is that whatever DIY promise various incarnations of the internet may have held, the contemporary net is pretty much entirely private property owned and controlled by various corporations. That's an observation made by many. We may well wish that things were otherwise, but ideals like freedom of speech don't have that much relevance when talking about infrastructure run by corporations. Where the limits of accessibility begin and end, wherever the people with the money decide. We might think from a certain form of speech should be considered accessible and ask our corporate overlords to allow it, or we might think that a certain form of speech is unacceptable and ask them to ban it. But either way, to think as though these entities can be motivated by moral principles and not by the logic of the market and capital accumulation is a dangerous delusion. Moving on, another area where the absolutist free speech position might seem more defensible is with regard to public space, or what's left of it. And that's an important point to make. There is not much public space left.
No.
The streets themselves are owned by drivers, you know?
Yeah.
They take priority, so they're not really public streets. If you're not in a car, they're not yours. You're not allowed there. Yeah, you're jaywalking. Making a crime.
I was on a sidewalk outside the Schenectady Library, and I was handing out flyers for the Green Party. And this woman was like, you can't do that here. This is public property. And I'm like, what do you mean?
Because it's public.
What do you mean I can't do it? It's public. It's for the people.
This is exactly where I can do it.
Exactly.
But I guess in her mind, public means owned by the state.
Yeah.
And the state can decide that political pamphleting for candidates isn't allowed because there's a practical reason to do that.
Right.
Like around polling stations.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But then when it's the library, it's like a distinction needs to be made.
Yeah.
This is the place for the exchange of ideas and political platforms. Otherwise, where does a political, and this is a problem the Green Party has. No one will host us. It's really hard to find people who will host us. Maybe for meetings where it's neutral and closed door, fine. But when it's public, a public meeting of some kind, it's hard to find. We either have to pay, it has to be like, you know, it can be amicable. There are places, but there's not many of them. Otherwise, it's a fight or like a, I don't want to get in trouble kind of attitude.
Right.
Or I don't know.
I don't want to make the Democratic donors that fund us uncomfortable.
Or it's social capital. Yeah. I have friends who will be upset with me, which is where a lot of the fear with online with a kind of outreach there is like, I need to put up a front that I'm blue no matter who, even if I'm not.
Right.
Because all of my other friends are, and maybe they're just afraid, or maybe they're thinking the same way. Oh, yeah. Okay. Public areas. Surely the free speech loving liberal might object, even if we allow printers to decide what they print and staff and students decide how campuses are used. Parks and streets must belong to everyone. But here, too, free speech as a general principle is a poor guide. Let's say a fascist group wants to use a particular park to have a nationalist rally on a particular day. Perhaps it would be a denial of their freedoms to refuse them. But what then happens? If, say, an anti-fascist group wants to use that space to hold an anti-fascist rally on that day, and a third set of people want to have a nice, quiet family picnic. An aim that's probably not compatible with either of them. If denying the fascists the use of the park on that day would offend against freedom of speech, then surely denying the other two groups the same space would be equally as bad. So again, when judging these competing claims, freedom of speech cannot serve as a guide. You have to make a choice of who you're prioritizing.
Right.
And that's a question of political power. And that's the thing neoliberal politics does. It takes power out of it. It says like there's a principle and we're following it.
Yeah.
No matter how many contradictions it creates. So that's a few situations where we can't rely on free speech as a principle. But this doesn't mean, as some might be tempted to conclude, that the concept is useless. As well as the conflicts mentioned above, all of which turn out on examination to be about access to particular resources rather than just speech itself. It is also the case that the state has the power to ban certain forms of speech outright. This, I think, is something that can rightly be described as a free speech issue, censorship, and is something that people who care about freedom should oppose. I look at history, so this is where the Cable Street comes back into the fray.
Yeah.
As someone who's a British writer, I assume. A look at history shows that there are many cases of laws and state powers being brought in on reasonable sounding, seemingly laudable grounds, only to be used in far more wide-reaching ways. In a recent exchange with anti-fascists, Matthew Feldman, an academic associated with the Center of Analysis of the Radical Right, praised the Public Order Act of 1937. So this was left out of the last article about Cable Street and how a coalition, a united front was formed that buried the fascists in Britain, particularly fighting. Once they were actually fighting Hitler, they definitely didn't have a leg to stand on, but there were the years before that.
Yeah.
Where if they did maybe gain enough seats, maybe they would have muddled the war effort.
Yeah.
As our current Congress does all the time when it comes to movements.
Yeah.
Beyond that. Okay. So, but there was a Public Order Act passed in 37, probably as a response to all the street violence. This academic says it was key in stopping Mosley's black shirts, describing it as use of law rather than force. Of course, the law is force.
Yeah.
To start with, this distinction between law and force is itself somewhat odd, suggesting that Feldman doesn't quite understand how the law functions or what a state is. Beyond that, any serious consideration of this act and its impact can't just stop with its application in the 30s, but has to include the way it was used against Irish Republicans wearing berets in the 70s and against striking miners trying to picket in the 80s. Similarly, the laws around radically aggravated offenses brought in by labor in the 2000s might seem like something that anti-racists should support, but it's worth bearing in mind that any laws, no matter how progressive sounding, will be enforced by the same racist state. An example of this can be seen in the case of Azhar Ahmed, who was prosecuted for making a tasteless Facebook post about dead soldiers. The CPS initially attempted to charge him with a racially aggravated public order offense, but eventually managing to convict him of posting a grossly offensive message. This man's prosecution, is just one of a number of cases where people have actually faced actual state censorship, and here in America, a ton of lefties have as well. While gaining attention from many of those who are most loudly concerned about free speech. We can also look at the case of Barry Threw. I'm going to skip ahead.
Okay.
And he talks about Charlie Hebdo and some fallout from that. Okay. At first glance, this might seem like one aspect of the situation that the Free Speech Brigade have done pretty well, talking about disinviting people from Oxford. As a fair proportion of the stories that get picked up as being about threats to speech involve people getting in trouble for things they say at work, but on closer examination, it's noticeable that a vast majority of these cases involve academics or media commentators. Hidden behind these stories are all the other cases of people being sacked, fired, or disciplined for things they say at work, things that are rarely seen as being shocking infringements on freedom or even that newsworthy. From construction workers being sacked or even blacklisted for speaking about health and safety issues, to every call center, warehouse, or shop worker who gets told to shut up and get back to work. Challenges or limitations to academic freedom or the free press tend to be picked up and treated as news, but it's taken for granted that work is a space of radical unfreedom for everyone else. Yeah. If a university teaching assistant gets disciplined for showing a Jordan Peterson video and insisting on making everyone discuss pronouns, it's news. But if you or I showed our colleagues a Jordan Peterson video during working hours and insisted on making everyone discuss pronouns for long enough, we would also quickly find ourselves disciplined, not because our views on the subject are so radically provocative, but just because it's not what we were paid to do. And while some workplaces are more relaxed than others, most of them were cracked down on any non-work activity sooner or later. Certainly, some forms of speech, anything likely to bring our employers into disrepute or the like, are liable to get stamped out pretty quickly. In light of this, the way that free speech advocates tend to ignore most workplaces and focus on a few professions is reminiscent of Bakunin's classic line about how liberty without socialism is privilege, injustice, and socialism without liberty is slavery and brutality. If you want to fight for free speech and you think that freedom should cover work, the place where many of us spend most of our time, then the freedom can't just be a privilege in the original and most liberal sense of the word, literal, reserved for academics and media. It has to be for everyone, which in turn means committing to defend the freedom for employees to defy their employers. This may be a daunting challenge, but it's a necessary one for anyone who seriously cares about freedom. And once taken, it's a first step that can lead in all sorts of interesting directions. I did have something open on the free speech and cancel culture stuff, and then you can go. Okay. If the signatories, so this is from my co-chair of the state Green Party, Peter Lavigne, quoting, I don't know if he's quoting it. No, he's quoting a place from HuffPost, which is "Don't fall for the cancel culture scam." This is post J.K. Rowling being a turf.
Yep.
If the signatories of the Harper's letter were concerned about larger issues of online abuse, death threats, and doxing, they could have proposed solutions to these problems, and they would have been right. Social media platforms could do more to prevent harassment. Police departments and other government agencies should also take these threats more seriously. Similarly, if cancel culture is really about ordinary people being fired after being targeted by social media mobs, the solution is clear. The vast majority of American employment is at will, meaning companies can fire their workers for any reason and at any time. A great way to fix this problem would be to advocate for stronger unions and better employment protection. But the moral panic over cancel culture, it represented by the Harper's letter, signed by all these academics and liberals, isn't about workers losing their jobs or ordinary people facing online abuse. Almost every example included in the Harper's letter involves powerful people, editors, authors, journalists, heads of organizations, being criticized from below. This is telling. Like most cancel culture punditry, the Harper's Letter is not aimed at actors with institutional power. It is almost exclusively directed at ordinary people who point out the failures of those institutions. Is there anything you have? I need, my voice needs a break.
I can find a snippet of the bread book. So here's a paragraph. I use a pencil. I read with a pencil so that way I can mark down
and erase. Cool.
So this is a paragraph. The note I wrote alongside it is every CEO a king.
Mm-hmm.
So the poor wretches, or the premise is that how would, say, if we were to establish a perfect anarchistic society, what would stop a billionaire from moving in and using their resources to expropriate the people and gain power within an anarchistic situation?
Like a community, commune,
yeah, exactly.
Or town.
So it goes, so the poor wretches swarm over the baron's lands, making roads, draining marshes, building villages. In 9 years, he begins to tax them. In 5 years, he increases the rent. Then he doubles it. The peasant accepts these new conditions because he cannot find better ones elsewhere. And little by little, with the aid of laws made by the barons, the poverty of the peasant becomes the source of the landlord's wealth. It is not only the lord of the manor who preys upon him. A whole host of usurers swoop down upon the villages, multiplying as the wretchedness of the peasants increase. This is how things went in the Middle Ages. And today, is it not still the same thing? If these were free lands, which the peasant could cultivate as he pleased, would he pay £50 to some shabble of a duke for condescending to him to sell him a scrap? Would he burden himself with a lease which absorbed a third of the produce? Would he, on the mater system, consent to give half of his harvest to the landowners?
And it isn't consensual. It isn't some contract thing, because if you settled there, the sheriff would be called eventually.
Well, the conclusion that I ended up coming to is, what do we do if a billionaire establishes self in our commune? Well, the answer is, we eat him.
Baked or fried?
That is an excellent question.
Have you seen the, I'm sure you have, there was a protest outside Bezos' house. I don't know which one.
Oh, yeah.
They built a guillotine.
Yeah, I saw that. I was so happy.
I thought they'd done that before.
Why
did it make you happy, though? They didn't actually do anything, Michael.
Well, every time I see a guillotine, I get a little bit happier. And then I made a post about a guillotine, and someone commented on my post with another picture that I had to take and share myself. It is the mega guillotine with a 10-foot long blade that can seat up to 15 congresspeople.
Hey, that is a call to direct violence.
In Minecraft, it can fit 15
Minecraft people.
15 congresspeople in Minecraft.
Yes, of course. Vote the bums out. Vote the bums out. What candidates do you have to replace them? Now, see, when they say vote the bums out, maybe they just mean don't replace them. In that case, you're talking about absolving the state, sir. But they don't actually imply that. I mean, I don't know if they do. They just want someone to leave them alone, right? They want to elect nobody. So it's like,
hey, I'm fine with electing nobody.
That's the thing with liberal democracy. There could be, like, the joke about, like, chicken or pig. You know, you could have two candidates, chicken or pig, and even if only five people vote in it, the state will declare a winner.
Right.
And that will be the representative.
Exactly.
And it's like, that's the farce of it. And it's true, because you could have a turd sandwich or giant douche. And whatever one wins is now, of course, that's a two-party system. To have alternatives, there needs to be a third candidate with the ability to compete. So that means public financing of elections. That means ranked choice ballot so that there is no defensive voting. Which, you know, is the case with the, you know, if everyone who does not want to vote does not want Biden or Trump to win, and is actually like a regular voter, which most
if
of them
they
are
all voted
now,
for Howie Hawkins,
he
Howie
would
Hawkins,
win.
Yeah, exactly.
He would win. Now,
I found a good sentence, and it describes the platform of every politician.
Go ahead.
Give me the power, and I both can and will free you from the miseries which press so heavily upon you. Don't give me the power. Give no one the power. Power is the problem, at least in my opinion.
Or a consolidation of it. It's
exactly.
Disperse it so that it's...
Power to the people.
Power to the people. That's what it means. So, the wrap up and bookend, although this goes to the pregame and start of the live stream, which is still going, where I talked about entryism, Green Party kind of position. I didn't argue for voting Green Party yet, but this is where I'm getting to. We have more of a left unity ticket than we've ever had. I really like what's happening. I think this is the beginning of what could be like an actual socialist coalition of groups that are all independent. And so, like, Howie and Angela have been endorsed by a growing number of independent socialist orgs that, again, are very small and don't have big cultural weight. But I think together we might actually have more fighting chance. All we need, like, if the DSA joined in, it would be perfect.
Exactly.
But the DSA leadership has actually banned or not let any local endorse the Green Party. So even if they want to, locals and state chapters, the leadership on the national level, because the DSA was originally founded as an entryist org of like, we'll be the left wing of the Dems. That's what we are. We can't be anything else. Even if all these other caucuses are founded in the DSA that say we're not that.
Oh, have you seen the anarcho-primitivist caucus of the DSA?
I know. Yes, there's every tendency is represented. Because the DSA is being sold as the mass umbrella left party.
Right.
But if the leadership is going to be stuck in their tendency from the 70s, then that's like a form of entryism, having your own caucus within the DSA. So have your own org, like, Howie Hawkins Walker have been endorsed now by Socialist Alternative, but then Socialist Alternative has also had something of a split, because you have a number of Socialist Alternative people who are also very entryist.
Yeah.
And this is a question about Bernie Sanders. So they would endorse Bernie Sanders' campaign, and for doing that, half or a certain amount of the membership there and leaders wanted to continue that and be more entryist. And but there's the other half that are like, what? We were like, we have Kavada Sawant, our spokesperson / elected councilwoman in Seattle, our poster woman. And she goes out on podcasts and stuff to say that the two-party system are both capitalist and imperialist.
Yeah.
And they will never represent you. And that is why Socialist Alternative is an independent party. So the other half, I mean, I think since Bernie Sanders dropped out and has started riding with Biden, and encouraging everyone else to do so, which of course gets the gamut of reactions. SA have endorsed Howie Hawkins since that, since the midsummer.
Yay.
But so has this independent socialist group, which is the split off from the SA, Socialist Alternative. So here's their statement. In the rapidly approaching 2020 U.S. presidential election, the Democratic Party and the Biden-Harris campaign offer no way forward for working people. With careers built on segregation and mass incarceration, Biden and Harris oppose universal health care, lack any serious plan for a just transition to green energy. It is crucial that workers everywhere, including progressives and any tendency of socialist, unite behind an independent campaign that will organize for far-reaching demands that advance our needs. After a series of internal discussions and a formal vote, Independent Socialist Group is declaring its critical support for Hawkins Walker.
Yay.
For president and vice president. As part of our internal discussions on their campaign, they have read The Case for Independent Left Party from the Bottom Up, available for free from the campaign website. Hawkins and Walker have made the question of a working class party independent of the two-party system central to their campaign and have stated clearly that this electoral effort will do whatever it can to further that goal. The Hawkins-Walker campaign puts forward a strong program with explicit calls for a socialist economy, an eco-socialist Green New Deal, single-payer health care. Furthermore, the campaign's platform includes far-reaching progressive demands for social and racial justice, indigenous rights, and demilitarization. That means big cuts to the Pentagon. It seems to be the strongest campaign on the left, the best positioned to raise the banner of socialism and discuss left ideas with a broad audience. We look forward to being involved in that campaign. And this is the argument they made for Sanders. That's the best positioned campaign to raise awareness and boost leftist thought. No longer. We look forward to being involved in the campaign. We would like our involvement to include bringing forward, blah, blah, blah. Now, they also say that we declare critical support in a positive way, aiming to engage with the campaign and its supporters, including open discussion about the program and tactics. Now, in this paragraph, they actually state, which a lot of socialist groups don't usually do, like, well, they will say, why aren't they Greens? Why aren't they, like, the Green Party is larger. It's better, like, why didn't they think it was better positioned before? They say, our critical support of Hawkins-Walker campaign does not extend to the Green Party as a whole in terms of its entire program, its actions, or all its candidates. Due to the political weakness of some of the party platform in some groups within the party. Additionally, while certainly not a corporate party run by big business interests like the Dems, the Green Party is not a due-paying membership-based party, though eco-socialists like Hawkins and myself advocate for that.
Yeah.
But we're not yet, which means its internal democracy is limited, with state party chapters holding too much power and internal politics dominated by career politicians, or careerists, or entryists. A major criticism that Hawkins himself has correctly raised. We do not believe the Green Party as a whole can form the foundation of this mass left workers' party. Which is also why you have all that other chatter about forming a new workers' party, you know, Bernie...
The People's Party.
Yeah, all these other groups that are they're having their own
Labor
conference.
Party.
Yeah, they're having their own conference in the fall. Because they're thinking of their eight-year plan.
Right.
We urge progressive socialists and other working people to break from the damaging pressures of lesser evilism by supporting and voting for the Hawkins-Walker campaign as part of an effort to build that said working class party and politics, which then can challenge capitalism and fight for our interests.
Right.
So my going forward, like my ideal scenario is similar to what happened with the Green Party event, like originally. Where you had two sides that merged. So we have the worst parts of the liberal Greens, which are that we're not a due-paying membership party, that we're just this anyone can join. Mm. We have state parties where you have the tyranny of the active.
Yep.
Which is the when they say professional politician, like they're not actually office holders, but they hold these chair positions for 10 years and they rule for nine and they don't let others talk over them.
Right.
Or if you insult them or criticize how things are going, they get really upset, they throw a tantrum, it's all very toxic.
Yeah.
But let's say the Greens, Socialist Alternative, Socialist Party US, and a few other groups, like there's one called Solidarity, which has endorsed Hawkins. Any of the groups endorsing Hawkins are potential partners to merge into a kind of new big Socialist Party,
and I would love that.
We could probably call it modeling after Germans, the Green Left Party, or the Red Green Party, something like that. Where the red and the green is there,
yeah,
and or United Left or something like that.
Yeah, and
then we can argue about our logo and all that.
Exactly,
but those are the sort of hard questions. The easy question is. We're due-paying member thing. We're going to have a caucus-based system, not just state-based, one or the other. Because in the Green Party right now, we have state parties, but we also have caucuses, but there are not many of them. There's like four or five right now. There's a Black, there's a Latinx, there's a Lavender, there's the Women's, there's the Eco-Socialists, which used to be the Young Caucus.
Okay.
Youth Caucus, which is now just Young Eco-Socialists. Because anyone who's for eco-socialism who isn't Howie Hawkins is like under 40. So
yeah,
and so on. And
yeah, I'm so happy with how radical the youth is.
And in the future, if we do merge in the super party, which I really want, like we could have that anarchist caucus who's always like pushing against any kind of the state program intervention kind of thing. Make sure we're all decentralists, and then we can have our anarchist friends. But really, it's they could be a real force. Or the Libertarian Socialist Caucus, which exists in the Libertarian Party. I kind of wish they would come over and then be a big-ass caucus here.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
With us. And because, you know, at the end of the day, like, I mean, they got some progress with Vermin Supreme.
Yeah. He's part of their caucus? Doesn't surprise me.
Not really. They endorsed him, though.
I know that Vermin is, like, effectively an ANCOM.
Yeah, he identifies as a agorist, which is a tendency which is, like, that actual absence of authority type of, like, what people think anarchism is.
Right.
Which is kind of why he meets expectations of an anarchist.
Right.
In the way he talks and the irreverency and the manner he is. As well as the, like, everyone should just be able to do their own thing.
Yeah.
And self-organize.
I watched Vosh's interview with Vermin Supreme, and I really enjoyed it. Like, I thought that it was a great insight. I've met Vermin Supreme, if you didn't know that.
I didn't.
It was...
I've seen him around, of course, and he goes to a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so maybe I've been around in the same place where he is, but that's not meeting him.
He went on a college tour, and he came to my college, and apparently the board who, like, approved Clarkson University's group is in charge of organizing, like, different talks and
their
different
committee.
Stuff. The committee on, like, whatever entertainment
the group,
or whatever.
The small group that's deciding who has speech, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They had no idea about Vermin Supreme. All they knew was he was running for president, and so they thought he was, like, a legitimate politician.
Oh, that's how he gets you.
And then he shows up, and oh my god, it was like the entire college packed into an auditorium.
Oh, yeah.
And
that was the plan of the Lib Soaks in... In the Libertarian Party is like he's a celebrity. He has celebrity.
Exactly.
JoJo, who the hell is she? She was a vice presidential candidate like 15 years ago for the Libertarians, and she has some sort of charisma, but she definitely represents like the purest strains there.
Yeah.
So they've kicked out all the Republican lights in the Libertarian Party for the most part, especially with this race.
Good.
Well, that's the thing with the bigger third parties have now effectively become more partisan in that, like, we're no longer trying to seek the middle or the disaffected Republican or socialist. There's now enough young radicals out there to say, no, the Greens are going to be eco-socialist. We're going to have a socialist candidate. And the Libertarians are going to say, no, we're not going to nominate a Republican governor again. We're going to nominate the pure Randian type of person who's like another SpongeBob meme was like she's like the magic conch.
I saw that
magic
one.
Conch. So what should we do about healthcare?
It was like, what should the free market do to help improve the quality of healthcare?
Nothing. The magic conch has spoken. Reference the SpongeBob episode. It was like the one where they're
Lost in the Woods.
Lost in the Woods. Yeah, I guess so.
I don't remember what it was called either, but that was a good episode.
But it's well, no, it's club. It's about the club. They're in a special club, and the club is the club with the conch cell. This show, Blue Turtle Shell's the 1%. Let me get to the. Thank you for listening. Profound thank yous. An important skill is listening, and as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback you send in, ideas for the show, or stories or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and CS alike don't believe work like ours is worth paying a living wage, so you could support us materially via Patreon, though I'm hearing Patreon has issues. Support with your time by telling others you believe would be interested about the show, liking and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts. Which we have all found by searching Three Left Show on those platforms. the last 10. Oh, okay, we're out of time. Bye-bye.
Oops.